Contamination won't be known until tests being done by all food retailers are completed next week.
The advice is that there is no danger to human health, so I hope we can give reassurance on that basis. Whether we can be as explicit about whether there is contamination, I think depends on the results and the evidence we're now getting in from, as I say, this massive testing programme.
A woman's thought to have taken her own life after giving evidence in the trial of a leading youth choir director who's been convicted of indecently assaulting her. 68-year-old Michael Brewer's been found guilty of sexually abusing Francis Andrade at Cheetham School of Music in Manchester. Claire Morlands is the current head teacher there.
On behalf of the current school staff, I wish to express my profound and sincere apology and regret. And most of all, I wish to express the sorrow and sympathy we feel for the family of our former student.
The European Union has agreed to its first budget cut in its history after 2 days of talks. The agreement sets a ceiling of €960 billion on projects the EU can promise to fund between 2014 and 2020. The Duchess of York is among 17 high-profile names who've settled their phone hacking claims. She's received an apology and the significant damages from newsgroup newspapers. It turns out the cause of the Super Bowl blackout was a faulty device that had been installed to prevent a failure of electric cables leading to the venue. The power company in charge of the Superdome in New Orleans says the mechanism had performed fine before. And Shirley Bassey is to make her first Oscars appearance at this year's ceremony in part of a tribute to James Bond's 50th anniversary. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show. Friday drive time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, now also Bristol's deputy mayor, Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as ever, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, one woman's campaign ends up exposing the biggest scandal ever in the National Health Service, with sick people being starved and left to die. New inquiries launched around the country. We try and get to the bottom of the scandal. Why did it happen, and how? More to the point, do we fix it? Also, Centrica pull out this week from the nuclear power programme. Is that good or bad for Bristol? We find out from Mike Birkin from South West Friends of the Earth. Plus, the Arab Spring has turned rather sour this week. One of the main opposition leaders is assassinated in Tunisia, the country which started the Arab Spring. And the country has been plunging into chaos with strikes and thousands of people out on the streets. Dan Glazebrook reports. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. Tonight, lows down to 1 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 5 Celsius, fairly wet tomorrow and on Sunday, but with some heavier downpours on Sunday and gusty winds. So you want to do something outside, do it tomorrow. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, a fairly cloudy week, with more showers at the beginning of the week and more sunshine towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of February, highs around 5 Celsius and a little bit better, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Jeff Gollop, who's now the Deputy Mayor of Bristol. You're a councillor also for Westbury-on-Trim. So how does it feel to be Deputy Mayor? What does it mean?
It means that ultimately, if anything happened to the mayor, I would be stepping into the position.
Okay, what are your thoughts about the way that the cabinet has been formed, this new cabinet? Because a lot of people in the Labour Party say it's very cheeky of George to actually be saying, well, I want this person and this person from the Labour group to be in my cabinet. Surely that's the prerogative of the Labour group to decide. I want this person, you know, that's for the Labour group to decide for themselves who they want to put forward into the cabinet, not for George.
I think it's an interesting issue. I think the whole issue about the mayoral campaign was over the power of the mayor. And ultimately, the system we voted for in Bristol just back in May was a system whereby all the power lies with the mayor. So the mayor ultimately is making all the decisions. And therefore, he can choose who he wants to be in his cabinet. And I think that's something we as councillors have to face up to. I believe the way it's worked with the other parties is by a process of discussion. So it's simply the mayor talking with the leaders of those parties to identify who would be available and who could be considered.
So it's a debate and a discussion between the mayor and the parties.
So it's got to evolve, but I think councillors have to recognise that Bristol's being run in a different way now, and it's really about working together, and those who are in the cabinet very much want to work with George to help make this new arrangement a success and make Bristol a better place.
Yeah, Bristol and George stood for Bristol First, this party, but actually, which was supposed to be an independent party. Actually, George Ferguson really is a Liberal Democrat, isn't he? He was in the Liberal Democrat Party right up until election time, and also he was a Liberal Democrat councillor before. I mean, don't you think really you're sitting with a Lib Dem in, as George actually being a Lib Dem in the running the council, and actually you're just a reflection of what's going up on in Westminster.
I can't disagree with you in the sense that during the mayoral campaign, when I was standing against him, I was saying exactly that. But I genuinely believe George has come into this as someone who is politically independent. And what he's actually trying to do is say that we've got to get away from the sort of slightly moribund way in which Bristol has been run, where there's always a good reason to delay making a decision, and to actually get on and move things forward. And I have to say, we there may be some issues that we won't agree on, but I don't think many Bristolians would disagree that we need someone who's actually getting things done and moving forward, and that's the way George is going to do it.
Helping George with the budget is a kind of big task, because for one man to be going through the budget, which is now passed, I mean, he was only elected back in November. He didn't have a lot of time really to go through the detail of it, but some people did, and they are three volunteers that George has brought in. One is Matt Payne from KPMG, the financial services firm. There's also Sean Cater from Wessex Water, and Malachi, I think that's how you pronounce it, Reynolds, from the old company that went bust, I think, didn't it? Elizabeth Shaw. I mean, surely councillors should be helping the mayor go through this, not volunteer advisors from business companies, particularly from KPMG. I mean, KPMG are actually still under investigation by the Competition Commission because they're one of the big four accountancy firms, which have been, you know, seen as not very good firms because they were responsible for signing off the accounts of the banking system before the crash.
Right. The advisors haven't been involved in great detail in the budget. What we have had discussions with them about is how we move forward, because the pressures on the City Council to cut spending are going to be in place for the next 3 years. And what we're very keen to do is to ensure that we improve the way we run the organisation rather than cut frontline services, if that is at all possible. And these the two individuals and one firm have offered to give a degree of help and guidance in that process, and that is all that they are doing at the moment. KPMG, as the only firm amongst them, are very clearly looking for some business, I am sure. But they are fully aware that if there was any contract to be placed as a result of this work, it would go into the public marketplace, and they would have no preferential treatment. So consequently, it is purely using some additional expertise to help, because this requires thinking outside of the box, outside of the conventional way that either councillors or local government officers would normally think about dealing with budgets. We've potentially got to cut £100 million off of a £350 million budget. So I promise you, every bit of help we can get in planning that for the next 3 years and making it as least painful as possible is going to be very positive. So I don't believe there's anything sinister to read into it at this stage. And all we've had is discussions. We're looking for some suggestions of ways that we can approach it that are different from the ways that we're considering.
Now, I'm not necessarily saying anything sinister, but there's surely a trust issue with KPMG, one of the big four that's being investigated for signing off the accounts of the banks in the run-up to the crash that later proved, you know, to be junk on these companies' books. But, I mean, surely there's a trust issue with KPMG. It's not a good idea to be bringing a company in that's being investigated on a national level for fraud.
I be very surprised if each of the big four firms haven't got issues of questions over what they have done. But equally, as someone who is an auditor myself, I recognise that the auditors actually can only do a limited amount of assurance in terms of some of these major issues. So I think I would leave the professional inquirers to carry out their findings in their own way. But actually, the four main firms are the best that is on offer. And if it is appropriate, we will use them. But if it's appropriate, we would use others.
Yeah, I would suggest probably the better firms to use are the sort of mid-tier auditing firms, people who aren't actually under investigation. But anyway, let's just go on to talk about some of the big decisions that are being made over the last few months, and years, really, are to do with planning permission for these big stadiums that have been going on. I mean, isn't the reality, Jeff, that our football clubs are actually bankrupt and they're desperately to do these property scam deals in order to survive? That is to say, getting planning permission on greenfield sites, you know, buying a cheap greenfield, getting a planning permission for a Wizzo stadium that's then suddenly overnight, as they get their planning permission, worth millions.
I have to admit, and maybe Martin can help here, because I have to admit, I do not understand the economics of football clubs. Mm-hmm. It is an extraordinary arrangement. And it is sad that playing fields, playing sports grounds, there are community asset centres where people have met for generations, are having to be redeveloped as supermarkets as the only way to provide clubs with the stadia, when actually they don't break even year on year, decade on decade, in playing football as they stand at the moment. It is remarkable, but we have to recognise as well that good sports teams and good sports facilities are a key bit of the profile of our city. And it is strange that a conurbation the size of Greater Bristol currently manages to only have a championship rugby team, just about a championship football team, and a just about a second division football team. Quite extraordinary. Most other conurbations of a similar size in the country would have a premiership football team. And we have to hope that progress with Stadia will be a key part of improving the sporting standard.
Okay, it's a good time to bring in maybe old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, can you throw some light on how these football clubs still exist with these rolling year-on-year massive multi-million pound losses? I mean, I'm positing here that they're so desperate to survive that they're trying to do these planning deals and, you know, as I say, buying a cheap piece of, you know, green land and then getting planning permission from Bristol City Council in many cases to turn that into this multi-million sort of all singing, all dancing stadium.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on the economics of football clubs either, but it does strike me as strange if you look at Manchester United, which is probably the most successful football club in the world. They were bought out in a leveraged buyout, and now, although their takings are massive, they're still struggling to survive because they've got this massive debt that they're carrying, which isn't, I think, the case with Bristol clubs. I think it's more deep-seated. But, I mean, I think this Bristol City, for example, I mean, their ground is right where their fans live, and they can all walk into it, and it's part of the community. If you build a big stadium out on the ring road, that's a different thing. I mean, I think this is very complicated. I mean, to make the economics work and the sport work is actually quite tricky, isn't it? You know, you've got to get both things right.
Okay, Martin. Also, what I would say the non-story of the week, the Royal Bank of Scotland fined over the LIBOR scandal. What do you think of the idea of fining a bank like this? Because, you know, it's, 20, 30 million pounds to RBS is not the same as 20 million, 30 million pounds would be to Jeff at the council or to you or I.
No, and in actual fact, they've said that a lot of it's going to come from the bonus pot. But of course, the people who are getting the bonus pot now are not the people who are responsible in the past. And I think the thing of holding institutions accountable, like RBS, which is 80-some odd percent owned by the taxpayer, is this misses the point. Individuals should be held individually responsible for their decisions, and they can't just pass it off to their organisation. This fine, really, if we were to really look into the libel fixing scandal, and there may be cases which will come forward in the US because the big municipalities in the US are going to sue about this. Fining people when they've been stealing, as it were, is pointless, because in actual fact the fine doesn't in any way cover what's been stolen. You actually have to send top executives to prison, which is what happened in the 1980s during the savings and loans scandal in the US. But of course, if we were really to go after the banks in this way, they probably wouldn't survive the inspection, which is why the authorities are loath to do it. But it just shows what a mess we've got ourselves into, doesn't it?
Now, what about these three advisors for George Ferguson on his budget decisions? Matt Payne from KPMG, Sean Cater from Wessex Water, and Malachi Reynolds from Elizabeth Shaw. I mean, it doesn't look particularly good. Malachi Reynolds coming from a failed business. I mean, you know, is he going to advise? Is he going to be the best person to advise George? And also, you know, that point I was making to Jeff just now about KPMG being under investigation at a national level.
Well, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, they're not being paid anything at this stage.
Nothing.
They're just being brought in as advisors, as, for example, I might be or somebody else might be. And they're being treated as individuals who are, I mean, KPMG aren't getting any money for this at this stage,
nope,
are they?
Nothing.
So in that sense, I mean, George, as has been pointed out, George is within his rights to ask for advice from anybody he wants. I mean, that's the setup, isn't it? I mean, I think it's good that there should be scrutiny about it, you know, on the radio and elsewhere. Mm. We need to know what's happening. The people of Bristol need to know what's being done in their name. But let's suspend judgment and see what they come up with.
Okay, on to our next story. And will George Osborne's bedroom tax add more to the welfare bill? Well, this is a story from Channel 4 News a couple of nights ago. If introducing new welfare reforms actually ended up costing us more rather than saving money, you might wonder what the point of it was. Figures seen by Channel 4 News suggested this week that could happen when the government's bedroom tax comes into force. The city council leader from one of the northern cities, Jeff, was saying that it could actually cost about £500,000 just for that city extra in housing benefit, because what would be happening is people with two bedrooms who are in social housing would all be forced to move into the social rented sector, which is actually much more expensive than the private rented sector, which is more expensive than the social housing that they were in. So this actually could end up, this bedroom tax, costing adding to the benefit bill.
Yeah, I mean, this is about reassessing where we're going and what's going on. And I think the concern that I think everybody has is that those who are most vulnerable need to have their support maintained. And that's really important. But what we also have to recognise is the amount of money that's being paid out in benefit at the moment is going not just to people who are most vulnerable and need it, but is going to people who are not as vulnerable, and it's potentially going to pay accommodation costs that are greater than they need to be. I mean, that's one of the examples. So what we're talking about is trying to alter the way benefit is administered so that it's more effective, more efficient, it delivers more. Now, the problem is that people who need are going to be suffering in the process. And I think there's going to be a very difficult year or two whilst the changes come into play. We've got the council tax housing benefit issue, which in Bristol, the council has decided it will maintain those levels of benefit at the same level. Other authorities are cutting by 10%. So Bristol's made a positive decision to maintain for those 40,000 vulnerable families the level of benefit. So it's a question of actually trying to be compassionate, trying to understand, trying to make sure that we are protecting those who most need it. But actually, the country's financial position is such that we have to see benefit as a lower proportion of the national expenditure, and we have to see private sector creating jobs to create the wealth to ensure that we can employ people at the right salary levels. there is going to be a difficult transition period for the next 12 to 24 months.
The trouble is, though, that these benefits are being paid to people who, it's almost as if they're saying, well, you know, we don't want to really pay you these benefits because you're being lazy. Actually, there's something like 6 or 7 people chasing every single job. I mean, all these people can't have jobs.
Yeah. No, that's why there's got to be a balance, and the issues that we're facing here. You know, just creating people as self-employed individuals doing work for modest amounts of time each week is not right for the individual. It's not right for the it's not right for the state. It totally distorts the figures, and all it does is result in those people needing further benefits or other benefits or being back needing support very quickly.
But that's another issue. But I mean, this bedroom tax particularly, and what Channel 4 teased out here is that by saying that if you're living in a two-bedroom house when there's only maybe a couple or one person in there, you've got to move, that the benefit bill for that person will actually increase.
Yeah, but one of the big problems as far as housing is concerned is that I don't have the figures for Bristol, but I know that there are circumstances where there are people living in houses that have far more bedrooms in them than they need. And the one thing the city is short of is accommodation for people who need four or five bedrooms.
But what's the point of moving somebody out of a house into a single bed, if you can actually find it in the private rented sector, that's actually costing more? Doesn't seem to make financial sense. I mean, you're an accountant.
That doesn't make sense in the slightest. But one has to look at who is in appropriate accommodation. We have to try and encourage the most appropriate. There aren't enough houses, so that we need more homes in Bristol. But that isn't a solution that can come about instantly. And so in the meantime, we have to make sure that the resources that are available are actually being used well, and that we are creating a situation that we're not paying housing benefit for people to be in accommodation that's not being used. I don't think that's unreasonable, as long as it's worked sensibly, not if it's just abused to create unfortunate circumstances.
Well, I mean, the example that I had on Channel 4 News was a guy who's dying of leukemia, and in his home he was brought up with, his parents lived in there and died there. He's got a spare room where he keeps various bits of equipment, sort of, you know, things that he needs. That's a spare bedroom, and he's now being told you're going to have to move.
Well, that's right. Come back to, there's got to be scope for some compassion in this as well.
Yeah. Before we hear from Martin on the bedroom tax, let's hear from David Cameron and Ed Miliband, who at Prime Minister's Question Time had an exchange on this very topic.
According to the government's own figures, two-thirds of the people hit are disabled. Let me tell the Prime Minister about an email I received last week. It says, my wife is disabled, has a degenerative condition and is cared for in bed. The gentleman goes on, due to her illness and my own medical conditions, I usually sleep in the spare bedroom. Why is it fair for him and hundreds of thousands of others of disabled people like him to be hit by the bedroom tax?
First of all, as with every honourable member, if he wants me or the Department of Work and Pensions to look at a specific case, of course I will. But let me again make some detailed points to him. First of all, there is a £50 million fund to deal with difficult cases. But let me also make the basic argument of fairness that he seems to miss. If you are in private rented housing and receive no housing benefit, you don't get money for an extra room. If you are in private housing and do get housing benefit, you don't get money for an extra room. So there's a basic argument of fairness. Why should we be doing more for people in social housing on housing benefit than people in private housing on housing benefit? And there's one additional point that, frankly, Mr. Speaker, he has got to engage in. The housing benefit bill is now £23 billion a year.
It doesn't sound like he's going to do anything for military families or the disabled. But let's talk about a group of people he is moved by. I have here a letter sent on his behalf by the Conservative Party Treasurer about the so-called mansion tax. And it says this. We promise that no homes tax will be introduced during the course of this Parliament. And it goes on, to keep the tax man out of your home, please help by donating today and supporting the No Homes Tax campaign. Can the Prime Minister explain? What is it about the plight of those people that he finds so much more compelling than those hit by the bedroom tax?
Well, if he's in favour of a mansion tax, why didn't he introduce one in the 13 years in government? If he's so passionate about social housing, why didn't he build any when he was in government? Spending too much on housing benefit, he's just said the bill's going up. Why does he oppose each and every attempt we make to get the welfare bill under control? The fact is, the public can see we are on the side of people who work hard and want to do the right thing. All he can ever do is spend more money.
Well, I mean, he's making a good point, Mr. Cameron, there, Master Summers, that David Ed Miliband, that actually all he seems to be able to do is to say we're going to have to spend more on this, but there isn't any more.
No, and he also made the point that they didn't do anything about social housing. It wasn't Ed Miliband, but the Labour Party didn't do anything serious about social housing when they had the chance for 13 years. And in fact, I totally agree with that. The housing benefit bill is rocketing up now as a result of the crisis.
As he said, they're £23 billion yeah. annually now.
I'm actually, as we speak, I'm actually working on a paper about this for the Human Cities Institute about the housing issues. So I'm actually reading a lot about it at the moment. And the fundamental problem is we haven't built enough affordable housing in this country for 30 years, and the chickens are coming home to roost now. But as Jeff rightly points out, the people at the bottom end shouldn't be made to pay the price for that mess up. We need to talk and think. What we really need to do, I'll cut straight to the chase. We need something like a land value tax, something like the rates as used to be, so we've got some budget money coming in, so the property speculators basically they're creaming us off, we cream them off, and we need to build social housing. The Prime Minister who built the most social housing in Britain was Harold Macmillan in the 1950s, because there was a wide consensus.
Now he's a Conservative, wasn't he?
He was a Conservative, because there was a wide consensus that there ought to be two, you know, pillars to the housing system. Home ownership, yes, for those for whom it was appropriate, but also subsidised housing for those on low incomes, because if you don't subsidise their housing, you then end up subsidising their wages, so in order to pay for the higher rents that they've got to pay. And it's a huge blockage in the British economy, the way we manage our housing stock. And of course there are no quick answers, but of course there are no quick answers just by fiddling around with the benefit system either. The fact that that more housing benefit is being paid out is a fault of the system, not the people who are claiming the benefit.
So I think what you're essentially saying, Martin, is you need to transfer the taxation onto the people who own the property, and they are, because they're wealthy and they can actually afford to pay it.
Well, if you think about it, the property bubble which burst made some people pretty well off, and they did very well out of it. And of course, it's a big political struggle in this country to get homeowners to I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder syndrome is alive and well in Britain. And people, middle class people, when they leave university, they get their foot on the housing ladder, and they basically get a free handout from society in general, not from the government. I mean, house prices in Germany haven't changed much in 40 years, and they're not supposed to. You know, the price of housing, I was reading a Shelter report yesterday, which said that housing costs, and we're talking about buying houses now, if food prices had risen at the same rate as housing over the last 20 years, a pint of milk would be worth £10, and it would be 30 quid for a chicken. And this is the problem, that we have this huge, we have booms and busts in the property market, which destabilises everything. It's a fundamental thing that needs to be looked at. And tinkering with the benefit bill is dealing with the symptoms of cancer rather than looking at the real problems, in my view.
Well, one of the problems that Ed Miliband pointed out there, Jeff, is that two-thirds of the people being affected by this bedroom tax, and by the government's own figures, are disabled people. So they're people who need that extra space in one way or another, and really can't necessarily be expected to just go out, get a job, get part-time work or whatever in order to pay the extra money that whatever it is. It's about, I think it's between about £15 and £20, roughly that figure every week that they have been getting for that, I suppose, for that extra bedroom.
Yeah, but as the Prime Minister said, there is a fund available to actually deal with those hardship cases. And actually, I agree with most of what Martin was saying there, that actually the real problem is that we do not have enough social housing. And I actually see one of the biggest problems for Bristol and its development over the next 10 or 20 years is actually going to be if we cannot provide affordable housing for the people we need to work in our services, in our industries, and for those who cannot afford to currently pay full rents for their properties, then actually the city is not going to be able to carry on growing at the rate it has.
Well, so this is one thing you can't actually blame the previous Labour government for wholly, because the present Conservative government massively reduced the subsidy to housing associations and councils if they wanted to build houses to spend on a second aircraft carrier for the Ministry of Defence.
But if you actually look, I mean, the Labour Party were admitting after their term of office came to an end that their social housing record was nowhere near good enough. So they recognised they did not get it right. This government needs, in my view, to do more, and we in Bristol need to make sure that we work with housing associations and ensuring that we can find ways of providing that housing. As I say, Bristol is going to not be able to grow at the rate it should if it can't actually provide housing for the people it needs to employ.
Finally, Martin, fascinated to hear that you're working on this report. How do we get rents down? Because that seems to me to be one of the fundamental issues here, that rents are far too high. When you actually consider what you get for your money, how much it costs to actually to get the bricks and mortar to build a house, and then how much you're having to pay every week for a house, it's just completely out of kilter, isn't it?
Well, it's all about supply and demand. I mean, and it's a sticky market, so there's a higher demand than there is a supply. But you've got to remember also people at the bottom can't bid directly into that market, which is the whole idea of council housing in the first place. Now, what if you've got a council housing sector, and if we were to have a push on social housing nationally, that would not do anything in the short run for property values for the private sector.
But it would provide jobs. That would be one good thing.
Yes, it would. Yeah. I mean, it would ultimately feed back into the private sector in such a way that, you know, as the economy picked up, because you could use housing possibly as a centrepiece for infrastructural investment. And I haven't given up hope. I haven't given up hope that this government can't be persuaded that that's a good thing to do, or even within the constraints that we have here in Bristol, it seems to me that all the political parties on the council are quite keen to do something about social housing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we can find the wriggle room to do something, then I think we should. And mm-hmm. if the current administration are prepared to put forward proposals to do that, I'm fairly confident that Labour people will support.
Martin, in your report, isn't the elephant in the room here actually immigration and the fact that we've gone up something like 15 million people in this country? That's why one of the main reasons why demand on housing is so massively greater than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Well, obviously it doesn't help, but on the other hand, basically, it's the first thing you learn in an economics textbook is every country can deal with any amount of people. You've just got to organise it properly. We've just been badly organised about this. This was all predictable, what's happened, and basically nothing was done. I think the reason being, to be honest, is the political power of homeowners, especially in marginal constituencies, is very big. And whoever the government is, they don't want to rock the boat by saying, actually, you know, that you used to be used to the idea that when you got on the housing ladder, you were basically going to have free money, which is what it is, you know, from
society.
But
you're suggesting that people may, people may have to go into negative equity then, people who borrow.
Well, they are in negative equity as things stand. I mean, what the reports I've been reading suggest that there will be a pickup in house prices as we go forward, because of the overall, the demand is too high. I have doubts about that, actually, because everybody presumes there's going to be a recovery. I don't think there is. I think at a certain point we're going to talk, all of us, about what kind of investments we need to break the back of the depression. And one of the key investments will be in housing.
Okay, Jeff, I was going to give the final word to Martin. He said so much, I think I should give it to you now. Are we going to see more social housing being built in Bristol, affordable housing of various sorts?
I certainly believe that has to be a key part of what we need. It was something that I was committed to in the mayoral campaign. It's something that George Ferguson is committed to. The other two parties were also very much seeing that as a main part of what they were working for.
Well, the intention is there, so is it going to happen?
The intention is there. And what we've got to do, you know, we talked about the budget. That was the thing that actually has taken everybody's energies in the first few months. But actually, the way we provide for housing is going to shape the future of this city. So we've got We have got to do it. Otherwise, we simply will not have the people to fulfil the jobs that we need. So it's an absolute essential. It must happen.
Okay, on to a story which you touched on earlier, which is the work advisors are pushing jobless into self-employment. This was from Five Live Investigates, which is a programme on Sunday. I think it's on Sunday mornings on BBC Radio 5 Live. Some people on the government's Welfare to Work scheme are being inappropriately pushed towards self-employment, the BBC's learned. It found they were being encouraged off unemployment benefits so they can claim more money from working tax credits. The work programme pays companies for helping people into sustained employment, including self-employment. The body which represents providers said there's no incentive to push people into unsustained work, but well, there clearly is. Sometimes five-figure sums are paid to these work programme companies. It's only right that work programme advisors help job seekers explore all possible avenues. Martin?
I think one of the problems you get with any system that you set up is people start gaming that system. As soon as you start measuring it in a certain way, they think, right, what we've got to do is move these people off unemployment benefit. That's what we're being paid for. Now, if they go on some other benefit, that's not your problem, because and that's not joined up, is it? It's basically, and that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get the benefit bill down. It's not all of these people, who, for example, who've been taken off disability benefit, and 40% of them win on appeal and all the rest of it. But even those who are removed, the 60%, what do you do with them? Well, you put them on job seekers allowance, which is only another benefit. And you actually haven't saved anything. And, and a lot of the process of moving them from one benefit to another is an expense in itself. And there's no, I mean, ultimately, I think we're going to have to have a society where we do have a universal credit. That is potentially a radical, sensible idea, but it should be an unconditional. And Milton Friedman was one of the first economists to put forward this idea. He called it negative income tax. Basically, every citizen of Britain gets enough to live on, basic. But then they can work on top of that as much work as they can find without being penalised. And even wealthy people get it, so they can't complain. The wealthy will get it as a tax credit. Yeah. So they and these ideas have been costed and thought about, and they're not left-wing ideas or right-wing ideas. They're radical economic ideas. But the idea that you can ultimately this what I fear is happening now is that rapid change, like in Maoist China, is just going to create chaos across the system. A lot of the people who've worked the system for years, you can say it's inflexible and sclerotic and so on, but on the other hand, people know how the system works. What you've got is people coming in at the top who haven't actually got much of an idea how it works, but they've got ideals in their mind about how it should work, but the real world is intractable. And, you know, poverty and dependency and all these things don't go away by waving a
magic wand. Before we hear from Jeff on this topic, let's have a listen to an extract from that Five Live programme where they spoke to a woman who had been disabled for many years, went to see her work programme advisors, and they persuaded her to become self-employed and then to go onto tax credits, the idea being that she could sell some of her stuff on eBay, and even though I don't think that's actually classed as work, and maybe do some ironing.
He made it sound like a bit of a dream, actually. Like, you get to keep your money and you'll get more money. He basically tried putting me off getting a job because I'd be worse off, and he kept indicating that I'd be better off financially being self-employed than being either on benefits or working. He'd say, because you have a disability, it'd be better for you, because if you're ill, you don't have to work. Which I couldn't understand how that'd be viable, because obviously if I was self-employed, I'd have to work to bring an income in.
What kind of things was this advisor suggesting you could do if you weren't self-employed?
Ironing, maybe Avon, selling things on Gumtree or eBay. He told me I could earn, say, £20 a week, so obviously that won't be a lot of hours, but I'd be able to claim 30 hours a week working tax credit, which to me seems quite fraudulent. Every time I said to him, no, I'm not interested, I'd rather get a job, he'd just begin again. He'd keep saying, no, there's no pressure, but I felt he was putting me under pressure. He just kept trying to reaffirm working wouldn't pay, it'd be better for me to become self-employed.
Self-employed though, but seemingly not really working.
Yeah, basically I could do a bit of ironing and earn £20 a week doing that and basically keep all my benefits. He was very pushy. He wouldn't take no for an answer. I actually thought he came across a bit like a car salesman. I think he would have said anything at all to try and get me to basically agree to his terms.
The trouble with that kind of thing, though, Jeff, is that someone who isn't actually working full-time and then is claiming full-time tax credits a couple of years down the line, once the work programme provider has got their fee, which is up to £13,000 for getting somebody off their benefits, then the tax man will come and come back and reclaim all those tax credits.
I mean, Martin's comment is absolutely right. Once you set up something like this that has some element of bonus in it for achieving, then somebody tries to exploit it totally mercilessly, totally inappropriate. In this case, one imagines that the advisor was on a bonus that he got paid as a result of getting someone off of the list. The fact that they were still on benefit and were actually fraudulently claiming tax credits is an absolute disgrace.
But that's been facilitated, Jeff, by a firm which is being paid by the Department of Work and Pensions with our taxpayers' money.
Absolutely, and it's not acceptable to me. That is not bringing any sustainable benefit. And sustainable is the key word. Whatever, if you get someone into any form of income that they can sustain on an ongoing basis, then that is entirely right. And we do need to do that. We need to create a culture where people recognise that work and producing an income for themselves is the right way forward. But again, Martin, I'm sorry, we're not making good listening if we keep agreeing with each other. But, but the negative income tax idea, you know, I mean, one of the most outrageous things that affects people at the moment is that if they start to work, the potential loss of benefit can be such that they are worse off. And you said, Martin, about it being understandable. I mean, I know as an accountant, I sit there and try and work out what the impact is on tax credits if someone's income goes up. And I have to say, I find it hard to understand. It is very, very difficult indeed. So we have got a system that actually penalises people who try to work, makes them feel worse off, and because they often then get caught repaying benefits that they were overpaid as a result of getting work, they feel victimised as a result of it.
Well, I mean, I started part-time work fairly recently, and when I did that, I just take in all my... I mean, the reason I'm being paid less benefits is because I've got another income, and what they do is they balance it out. They'll take whatever income I'm getting off of the benefit.
Yep.
The trouble is, of course, for many low-paid people, they can't survive just on that pay. No. They need the benefits too. Martin, anyway.
Well, I think we're starting to get to the nub of the matter here. I think ultimately society will start looking at this. I mean, the point about making you better off in work, you can either do that by making life on benefits a miserable existence. I mean, that seems to be where we're going.
Oh, food banks, you mean?
You're going to be constantly harried, bullied, people are going to be getting at you. I mean, there's a lot of psychological distress at the moment amongst people on benefits, I know for a fact. Lots of people I know are very worried. But the other thing is to give people basic security and then say, once you're comfortable, then you can work an hour. You see, if you take an hour's work, then it's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when I've been unemployed, if you try, there's no point getting... I mean, you could get bits and bobs of work, but then what would be the point? You then lose your housing benefit, and then you become homeless.
I'll tell you what the point is. It's actually doing work. It's actually then helping you get into work by showing
the labour market so that people can work as much as is suitable for them.
If, and that's a very big if, but if the new system works with the universal credit and the Inland Revenue real-time information, we should have a situation where adjustments are made much more quickly. And that is one of the problems at the moment, that changes in circumstance can take a very long time to come through. And actually, there is no incentive to get a job, because if you take a short-term job, by the time the benefits and the tax are corrected, you're probably out of that job and you've got to get it corrected
again.
This is
the advantage of negative income tax.
Exactly.
It's the administration is that much more simple.
Yep.
If you are on the electoral register as a citizen of Britain, you will get your money. Bang.
Yep.
And that's it. And you don't have to... You see, all of this kind of means testing that needs to go on and readjustment, you don't have to bother with that.
Now, you just mentioned the real-time information thing that's coming in as well. That's a massive bureaucratic nightmare for a lot of people, that they've got to give information all the time. I think it's weekly, isn't it?
People are self-employed and on on benefit will have to report their income monthly, which is an extraordinary concept, because certainly quite a number of self-employed people can't measure their income monthly, where they're involved in projects or contracts or whatever. They, once a year is when they can actually assess what their income was for the year. So there are numerous issues, but it is part of a change in the way benefits work that ultimately, hopefully, will make it easier for people to work whilst on benefit, because at the moment the disincentive is too big.
Well, the working tax credit effectively does that. You know, we're kind of halfway there anyway. I mean, you know, reality feeds back, and people dodge their way around the system one way or another. But we should, if we're going to simplify the system, and in principle having a universal credit would make sense, but it's got to be done in a non-punitive way. And also, of course, a lot of the politics of this are quite poisonous, the sort of, you know, the shirkers behind the window and all the rest of it, which is creating a lot of bitterness and social division.
Okay,
and I don't
Martin.
Think that's what we really need.
Okay, another story, big story, that is to do with horse meat contamination. Some Findus Lasagna products made from 100% horse meat. Now, this has come from France, Poland and Ireland, Jeff, this horse meat, apparently, because we don't slaughter horses here, but... Or at least certainly doesn't go into the food chain in Britain. But the question here being, why are we still importing meat from France, Poland and Ireland when we know that the imported meat in the past has been contaminated, some of it 100% horse meat?
Well, you know, I think it's even more than that. I had a client that I audited years ago that was a large abattoir, and they could trace every animal that came into their abattoir, where it had come from, and indeed what it was fed as well. And yet we hear a situation where what we're now being told is that they can't actually trace where these animals came from, and therefore whether what sort of contamination there might be. So it seems extraordinary that we have a whole series of rules that are applied in this country about controlling the quality of meat, and yet we're able to consume meat that's imported from another country that isn't even what it says on the packet. I'm absolutely amazed that this is still happening, and I must admit I'm wondering what else is going to come out, because I think this is the third story we've had in a week on quality of meat.
On the Findus label, Martin, it says good food made Findusly simple.
Fiendishly simple, yeah.
And fiendishly not actually beef lasagna. So what lessons are there to be learned from this, and why are we still importing meat from these countries which have clearly been lying about what meat they're selling us?
I mean, this is the European single market, isn't it? We've got our animal welfare standards and so on, and other countries have got theirs. Mm. But is it a single market, as Jeff says, where meat can cross the border? Mm. I think ultimately we need to move towards a food production system where we don't just go for cheap food. Yeah, you can't buy a £1 chicken, because we're not going to have those kind of chickens produced. But if you're going to do that, you have to put your universal credit or whatever at a level where people can afford to buy the organic chicken. And that's the way around that, so that people really have the money to buy the proper stuff. And with this whole idea that the cheaper everything is, the better, well, it's not always so, and certainly not when it comes to food. And of course, you know, the Tesco's or Asda will say, well, we're providing cheap food for people on low incomes. Fair enough, but we don't want people on low incomes, and we don't want cheap food.
So what you're saying is essentially that the single market actually makes it impossible to regulate, because you don't know what you're getting from other countries.
Not impossible, because it would still, you know, if you're going to regulate something, you've got to regulate it properly.
This hasn't been regulated, has it?
But you see, what's interesting is, as well, in terms of the abattoirs, they have a series of European Union regulations as to what has to be done. In a UK abattoir, there will be ministry vets on the premises every day to ensure that things are being carried out appropriately. If you go to some of the Mediterranean countries, I think you might find that there isn't quite the same zeal and enthusiasm.
Well, I remember last year, actually, there was quite a big scandal about mistreatment of animals at abattoirs here in Britain, and several of them where animals were treated absolutely appallingly within those animals. I don't think there was any ministry inspector around at the time. Anyway, on to our next story, and this one is about Scotland Yard, who've been stealing the identities of dead children.
have undercover police gone too far stealing their children's identities?
In most situations, a person's name is only used as a way to get through a door, as long as they're not damaging the reputation of that child through what they do. And if it's contributing to the greater good, then I suppose it's a necessary evil. But at the same time, obviously, you wouldn't want someone taking the identity of your children without your permission. If you're trying to achieve something that's quite difficult to achieve, does the ends justify the means? Suppose it depends what the ends was, and suppose it depends what they were trying to do.
Wrong word, and I don't think they've gone too far in doing what a dangerous job they have to do. I think it's quite acceptable.
Well, I think so, yes. But if they had a job to do, they needed to find a way of doing it. So, who knows? I still think it was unethical, but they needed to do a job, so they should have found a different way of doing it. In principle, I wouldn't agree with it.
I suppose it sounds heartless, really, but I suppose it's a victimless crime, really. They're taking these identities and using them in the name of good, aren't they? It sounds horrible, but I suppose the children don't need the identities, if you know what I mean.
What do you think of the practice of undercover police officers who leave these innocent women under a false name, have children with them, and then disappear?
That really does raise the question of, like, what is of the moral and psychological background of the undercover police officer? Because how can you live with someone for 6 years and then abandon them, you know? Like, regardless of whether it's your job or not, I think you'd have to be quite an interesting person to be able to do that.
Well, it's just completely morally reprehensible to do that. I agree you should have these undercover police officers, but to go that deep into community and actually get married, have children, just in the course of their duty, that's completely abhorrent.
That's not a very good scenario at all. No, I don't agree with it.
Well, that's terrible. That is unethical to the extreme. That one's just, there's no defending it really, is there?
Yeah, so two cases there where people are questioning police practices, particularly to do with undercover officers, Jeff. The first one was to do with where police are, at the moment there's a court case going through with 20 women who've had undercover police officers form relationships with them.
It's only 10, isn't it?
And subsequently have children. The other one that we heard just there stealing identities of dead children. What are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of that? And, you know, my feeling being really that sometimes the police are actually coming quite close to being criminals themselves by doing these sorts of activities. And also many of the women, for example, weren't actually criminals, hadn't committed crimes. They were organising legitimate, legal, quite lawful protest groups.
Well, I think if we deal with the children's names first, I guess that what happened was someone thought, well, we don't want to use a real name of someone who's alive, so we want some names. Well, why couldn't they have made up names? I mean, to me, it's the morality of it. If it's someone who's not alive, it doesn't matter whether it's a real name that was once used or not, but it would be far better to not use a name of a child who had died. I find that unbelievable. I don't think there's anything criminal in it. It is simply a question of not being what one would consider to be normal human decency.
I mean, if I, for example, went through social security records and you know, maybe decided I was going to take on this personality, I mean, surely that would be a crime.
It would be a crime if you took on the personality and you were imitating
that person. Using all, yeah, that's exactly what the police are doing.
But if you're just using that name and not taking...
Well, they were using things like social security numbers, this kind of thing, so that it was as if they were just that person. They were doing things like going to the job centres, claiming, in order to sort of go deep cover, I suppose.
I mean, as I say, I would have believed there were proper ways of doing that without imitating people who were no longer alive. As far as the actual having undercover and forming relationships as part of that process, whilst I'm a great believer in the rule of law and actually protecting individuals, I cannot believe that is an acceptable way to carry on. And I don't believe anything, however serious the crime that might be committed would justify that level of infiltration, if you like.
Martin?
I think what this reveals, actually, I mean, the Metropolitan Police have been running this programme since 1968, so you can imagine them sitting there in 1968 seeing all these protests and stuff going on. Oh, we're going to have to do something about this. So they set off to infiltrate the movement, as it were. I mean, what strikes me about this is the sheer disproportionality of it. If you're infiltrating Al-Qaeda or the Irish National Liberation Army, you might want to use some of these techniques, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't want to talk too much about it.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about here is the Clown Army, Cardiff Anarchist Group. I mean, these people basically are harmless eccentrics at worst. And, you know, the idea that they're a threat to the state to the extent where you've got to infiltrate at this level strikes me as completely disproportionate. But there is, and always has been, a state within a state in Britain. And these things, but what they've got to remember is these things come back to bite you in the bum. And they're coming back. In actual fact, it may be found that all of their actions were illegal and that the people concerned who gave the orders will have to go to prison if there's going to be a rule of law. You're not allowed to steal people's identities. You're not. That's, in fact, illegal. As Tony's just pointed out.
Well, actually, there's a bit of a scare about identity theft for the rest of them. Maybe, you know, the police have been doing it for a long, long time. Anyway, today we've had some news. The Iraq war activists are getting £4,000 compensation over a protest in 2003. Another policing story we'll finish on. Martin, this was about a busload of people on their way to Fairford a couple of days after the first bombing raids on Iraq in 2003. And the police have again been found to be way outside their remit, stopping a legitimate protest. And everyone on that coach getting £4,000 compensation.
Well, the police were just wrong to stop the coach, but the system has worked because it's gone through the, you know, but what in this case, the police have been found to be in the wrong and they've had to pay out. I mean, they should never have stopped a coach on the way to a legitimate protest, but they did. And now, I suppose, what happens with this is that it's actually the taxpayer, not the individual police officers, who will pay the £4,000.
I suppose this is the problem,
isn't it? The
individual
police officers should have to pay the £4,000.
Is that this decision has been made to stop this coach, but actually the people who are responsible for that decision aren't picking up the tab. The taxpayer's picking up the tab.
That's so often the case. And I mean, I firmly believe in people's freedom to speak, even when I disagree with what they're saying. And you know, I mean, one simply cannot have a situation where the rule of law is being applied by people who are using it to pursue their own beliefs and views. They can only actually detain people when they've done something wrong. What they were doing was expressing an opinion. There was no will to do anything wrong. So, you know, Martin's absolutely right. The case has defended that right. But it's like so many things, you cannot name or penalise the individual who made the decision. And I believe in public life there's got to be a lot more accountability for the individuals who make decisions to actually stand up, defend those decisions, but actually pay the penalty if they go wrong. And whether that's a police officer or whether that's a senior banker, going back to the LIBOR issue, individuals have to be held responsible. They can't hide behind some corporate mask of their employer if they've made an inappropriate decision.
Thanks, Jeff. £390 million, by the way, was the LIBOR fine. I've just looked that up, which is peanuts for RBS. Anyway, we're coming up to the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for West Beyond Trim, and also Bristol's Deputy Mayor, Jeff Gollop. After the news, one woman's campaign ends up exposing the biggest scandal ever in the National Health Service.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the government has refused to rule out the possibility that horse meat might be found in food served in schools or hospitals. It follows the revelation that some Findus beef lasagnas made by a French food supplier contained up to 100% horse meat. In Brussels earlier, the Prime Minister wouldn't be drawn on whether...